This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The arrival of climate change has been described as a black swan event. It is something we humans have never experienced, and awful impacts are possible. Now, as the weather goes weird and the poles melt, why can't we act against the obvious threat? Rupert Reed is a British academic and Green Party politician. He has worked with the well-known black swan author Nassim Taleb. In the February 23rd issue of The Ecologist magazine, Rupert argues climate change is a white swan. Rupert is the chair of the Greenhouse think tank. He has been the UK Green Party spokesperson on transport and a respected reader in philosophy at the University of East Anglia. I think it's time to meet Rupert Reed. Rupert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, good to be here.
We have lots to talk about, but why not start with a question any sane person has to ask? We see climate change looming like a dark cloud over the future, so why are we frozen or running in the opposite direction as they are in the United States and Australia at the government level anyway? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so this is really what I'm trying to get at in my thinking about climate change as a white swan. What I mean by that is that now we can see climate change coming straightforwardly towards us. It's no longer a surprise distantly on the horizon. We look at the events in the polar regions right now. We look at the continually rising global temperatures. We see the scientific models getting surer and surer. We've got 99%, not 97% of climate scientists now on board with the accepted wisdom that dangerous climate change is happening and that it's man-made. It's no longer unexpected. It's as common or as expected as seeing a white swan on the river. It's not a surprise anymore. So why can't we see this and respond to it? Why can't we act on it? There's a number of reasons. I think one of the most simple ones is that there are some people with a strong vested interest in continuing for as long as possible to deny what's happening, and they include, of course, fossil fuel magnates, the fossil fuel companies, and so on. But it goes deeper than that. I think that something really strange and worrying is going on, where it's now so obvious that this threat is hanging over us, so obvious that it's dire, and yet there are so many people still in denial. And I argue also that in some ways, most of us are actually at a certain level in denial. We can't really face the extraordinary reality of what is tragically starting to happen. I think it raises big issues for our psychology. I think it raises big philosophical issues as well as political and economic issues, obviously. So I think we need to do a lot more thinking about this as well as getting on with it and starting to act on it, because this is dire. It's going to get worse, and our children will never forgive us if we don't get it sorted.
Meanwhile, many of us have been expecting, I think, some sort of paranormal event, a climate impact so gigantic and terrible that all the nations will unite in a rapid response. But what if climate change just crawls in instead, making our lives a bit more difficult and more miserable over the years? What if that's how it arrives?
Yeah, well, that is part of the problem. Part of the reason why it's so hard to grapple with and act on is it doesn't strike people as an emergency. So comparisons are made, for example, with the Second World War. And in many ways, the comparisons are apt. So there was a Holocaust in the Second World War. The devastation that climate change could wreak could be, in the long run, far, far greater than that in terms of the number of people killed. The threat in the Second World War demanded serious action, and yet people were at first slow to act. Winston Churchill was accused of being an alarmist for raising the alarm about what was happening in Nazi Germany. And he said, that's exactly what he said. He said, look, I'm not an alarmist. I'm raising the alarm. There's an important difference. But of course, it was much easier to respond to because it was a threat that was kind of in people's faces, at least by about 1938, 1939. It had a clear enemy. There was a clear trajectory as to what you needed to do to deal with it. These are features which are not present in the case of climate change, which is why I call climate change a diffuse object. It's an object which is very, very difficult to see. It is long-lasting. It is all around us in a certain sense. It is influenced by virtually everything that we do. But, you know, when you started saying, Alex, that what if it's so slow and then we don't react to it, the analogy which is often used is that of frogs, the idea that frogs, if you put them in water and slowly boil the water, that they will get boiled. And what I say in response to that is, it turns out that that isn't actually true, that your average frog will jump out of the water at a certain point, even if you turn up the heat very slowly. So one way I like to put this is, can't we be at least as smart as frogs? Right? Can't we be as wise as frogs? One would have thought we were wiser than that. The great philosopher Aristotle said, the thing which is special about humanity is that we are the rational animal. Well, that question is now in the balance. Are we the rational animal or not? If we are at least as rational as frogs, then we will address this, even if it just keeps creeping up on us slowly. And so I think that's maybe a hopeful thought, because I think surely we are at least as rational as frogs.
You know, I've never had the courage or the stupidity to test that out, you know, throw a frog in a bucket and see what happens.
Well, it'd be a bit cruel, wouldn't it?
It would indeed. But we're being very cruel to our children and our grandchildren by carrying on in this warming bucket without taking any action. And I know that you presented a shock message for young students. What did you tell them?
Well, yeah, what I told them was that we are in unprecedented times, that it's no longer possible for us to assume that life as normal and business as usual will go on. I told them that although this was an address to freshmen arriving at university, although it was a wonderful thing to be arriving at university, I frankly, in a very important respect, didn't envy them, because young people, I'm 50 years old, young people are going to face a lot more of this than I am. I mean, I'm very worried about my old age, frankly. I'm worried about what kind of world we're going to be living in. But if you're 15 or 20, it's absolutely a terrifying prospect, if you can dare to look it in the face. Well, what does this mean? Well, it means that we have to act. We have to respond. We have to look at this. We have to do it urgently. We also have to do it in a deliberate way over a period of years. It's not going to get solved overnight. If we're going to solve it at all, it's going to take a long time. So then I started to talk with the students about the kinds of things we need to be doing differently. One of the key things, it seems to me, that needs to be brought in now urgently and strongly is the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle basically says that if you're not sure how bad something is going to be, but you know that it could be really bad, then you need to act preemptively to stop it. And that does apply to climate change. I mean, we are sure that climate change is here, basically, unless you're some kind of extremist like Donald Trump. We are sure that climate change is here. We are sure it's man-made. We are sure that it will be bad unless we stop it. But we aren't sure just how bad it's going to be. And some people use that as a prevaricating technique. They say, well, you know, maybe it's not going to be as bad as they say. But of course, the truth is that if you're uncertain how bad something is going to be, that it doesn't just go one way. Climate change could be a lot worse than we think. It could be a lot quicker. It could be a lot more devastating. There are feedbacks that could come in. For example, if we get the Amazon rainforest dying off relatively quickly, or if ocean currents stop working properly, or if there is a sudden jump in methane levels being released in the polar regions or in the seas, dangerous climate change could be a lot worse than the scientists are telling us. The only rational thing to do, the only precautious thing to do, this is what the precautionary principle says, is to act now strongly to stop the worst-case scenario from being able to happen. And, of course, we know the kinds of things that means. It means changing our farming methods radically. It means stopping deforesting the earth. It means, most obviously of all, stopping burning fossil fuel so much, and we have to leave the clear majority of them in the ground. This is going to be very difficult to accomplish because we're dealing with huge vested interests and long ingrained habits. But we can do it. We could do it. And so the responsibility is absolutely on us to do it. And this is why, although in a certain sense it's a terrible time to be alive and a terrible time to be young, in another sense it's an awesome and a hugely exciting time, because what an incredible responsibility, what a chance to be the people who have the chance of actually saving the future and changing the destiny of humankind and putting us onto a much safer track. That is a positive way of looking at the awesome responsibility which now hangs over all of us.
Yes, there's both hope and fear for us there in the younger generation. I want to switch gears a little bit. You know, I've collected pages of headlines warning that robots are coming to take our jobs, all sorts of jobs. And at the Greenhouse Think Tank, I noticed that Andy Permain published an e-article titled Newer Times, what the age of robots means for labor and green politics, but it seems to me in response you seem to call robotization almost a distraction. Why?
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about robotization now, including, as you say, from my colleague Andy Pearmain in the Greenhouse Think Tank. I think that something which has been neglected in all this talk is that the kind of robot utopia or dystopia, whatever it is, that people are talking about and are imagining and saying and are saying is starting to happen already, if that comes in, it's going to demand an enormous increase in use of energy, an enormous increase in use of materials. Now, people say, no, it won't, because robots can be brought in fairly efficiently and so on. But the question here is this. If you're going to have robots additionally to all the people that there already are, then it's bound to increase the pressure on the Earth. It's bound to increase energy use. It's bound to increase materials use. I'm very worried about the amount of waste that's going to be generated by broken robots and finished robots and so on and so forth. So why does this mean that I don't actually in the end think that the worry about robotization taking away all our jobs or indeed robots conquering the planet and ruling over us all, why am I not so scared about this as many people are? Well, because I'm more scared of something else, which is that I think that the likely scenario, if we do go down a heavy robot-intensive route of further industrialization in the next 10 or 15 years, is that we will simply hasten ecological collapse. Because the Earth cannot tolerate any more burdens on it in terms of resource extraction, pollution, energy overuse. We're straining up against, we're breaching the limits to growth. Dangerous climate change is simply the most obvious symptom of this and the most direly, directly harmful to us. So what I think will happen if we do go down the robotization path, as currently seems to be likely, unless we manage again to change society's direction quite radically, what I think is likely to happen is it will simply accelerate ecological collapse. It will simply accelerate the time when we start to go into a vicious circle of worsening conditions and societies falling apart, most likely, although not necessarily, through climatic disaster, through a series of climatic disasters, indeed, which people call climate chaos, as well as just the general ratcheting up of the temperature worsening the climatic situation for us across the planet. Robotization, if it's not stopped, I think is less likely to lead to a kind of robot apocalypse or even to robots taking away all our jobs, and more likely to lead to an intensified and more rapid period of climate disaster. And now here's the thing. If the robot lovers, if the people who say, oh, robots are going to be great, you know, they'll give us all a leisurely future, etc., if those people are actually serious, if they're saying that robots can actually reduce our ecological footprint, remember we're living right now in countries like the UK and the US as if we have four or five planets. When I last looked, we only had one. If those people are right in thinking that robots could actually reduce our ecological footprint, then they have a very interesting and actually very unpleasant thing to explain, which is how is that going to be possible without a massive forced reduction in human population? Because that's the only way I can see the figures adding up. You see what I'm saying? If the robots, as they inevitably are going to do, are going to have a significant ecological footprint, a significant impact upon us ecologically, the only way the figures add up is if there are a hell of a lot less humans quite quickly. So what I would like to ask the advocates of a robot future is, which humans precisely do you want to replace? Which people or which peoples are going to be told that they cannot reproduce or indeed forcibly contained in their numbers? What's it going to be, a mass sterilization program or something? The only way that the figures add up, the only way it's going to be possible for there to be a robot-heavy future which doesn't destroy us ecologically is if there are hugely less people very quickly. I say that's not possible. I say, therefore, that in order to have a humane future, we have to stop the trend towards robotization. Don't get me wrong, by the way, Alex. I don't believe that the currently very high and growing human population of the world is sustainable. But that's even without robot growth in numbers. I think what we need to do is find a way of gradually building down the numbers of human beings on the planet through non-authoritarian means. We need to persuade people through family planning and through thinking rationally about what will be a better human future and so on and so forth, that it would be better to have a globe on which there were 7 billion people than 10 billion, and maybe in the long run better to have one with 5 or 6 billion, and we can carry on thinking about what exactly are the best numbers, the numbers which actually add up to human life on Earth being compatible with our ecological stability, as well as being a flourishing, enjoyable life. But all you do, if you add on robots on top of that, is you make it harder and harder to have an ecologically stable and sane future. So that's why I say no, robotization cannot go on in the way that people are talking about. And people who are thinking about things in a green kind of way have to start talking about this.
There is a whole bag full of really sharp knives in what you just said. I mean, I could see a point where the billionaires meet in a little room and decide they don't need a few billion of us. Or I could see that robots themselves would have to become consumers because we won't be able to afford the products that they make, and on and on. I have to get something in here. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Rupert Reed from the University of East Anglia. We're talking about why real action on climate change is such a struggle for all of us. Now, part of that struggle, Rupert, has been the Green Party, and particularly in Europe, it's been green politics. What has been your role in that?
Well, so I've stood a number of times for Parliament and for the European Parliament. Unfortunately, of course, we have a very inequitable political system in Britain, as we do in the US and in most countries, frankly, in the world. It's very hard for the Green Party to break through with the electoral system. And even when the electoral system is fairer, even when you have proportional representation, it's still hard for the Green Party to get fairly represented because the media are stacked against us. We don't have rich donors like most of the other parties do. So it's hard to make progress as part of the Green Party. I see the Green Party as a vital part of the chance we have, which is, I think, frankly, a slim chance, but it still exists, the chance we have of saving ourselves and returning to some kind of ecological sanity. Because we need to be acting at every level. We need to live in a different way in our day-to-day lives and in our communities. We need to act in our workplaces to try to change those. And, of course, many of us have real power as laborers, as workers, especially if we're in a trades union, as I am. And we need to act in the political system, and that means things like direct action, it means things like demonstrations and lobbying, but it crucially means elections too. I say to people sometimes, why lobby your member of parliament if you could be your member of parliament? And that's what I've sought to be, unsuccessfully as yet. Hopefully that may change in the future. We do, of course, have some brilliant elected green politicians in the UK, including at the head of us all, Caroline Lucas, our absolutely amazing member of Parliament in the Houses of Parliament for the Green Party.
Yes, indeed. Now, as you know, Rupert, every politician promises growth. We've been told the economy will collapse into massive unemployment without growth. And the Greenhouse think tank has a post-growth project. What do you mean, and how could that work?
Yeah, so this is another crucial part of the picture. As you say, Alex, unfortunately, the idea of economic growth still remains largely hegemonic. It remains largely dominant around the world and in public discourse and in the media. And this is basically a disaster. It's a continual ecological disaster in the making. Because the more growth that you have, or the more you try to bring about economic growth, the more pressure you place on ecosystems, the less room you leave for wildlife, the less room you leave for the kind of functions that the Earth performs for us in terms of regulating and absorbing pollution and so on and so forth. So, yeah, we in Greenhouse are saying we have, as a human race, and we have in our societies, to start to think beyond economic growthism. After all, what is growth supposed to be for anymore? We already live in countries like the United States, Canada, and the UK. We already live in a position where most of us, frankly, have enough. Now, of course, some of us don't have enough, but some of us have way too much. We need to share better. That's what we need to do, not grow the economy more. We need to get the rich to give up a little of what they have, and then everyone will have enough. We don't need any more economic growth. And economic growth, as I say, it simply puts more and more pressure on our vital ecosystems, without which we are nothing. Every bit of economic growth means more straining against the limits to growth, limits such as the capacity of our atmosphere to absorb pollution, limits such as the fact that raw materials, so-called, are running out. So in Greenhouse, we have this post-growth project. If people want to look at it, I'd urge them to go to our website, greenhousethinktank.org, and find out more about it. We're part of an alliance around the world, the Post-Growth Alliance, of people who are thinking the same way. And this kind of thinking is gradually starting to become acceptable as people realize that growth isn't all it's cracked up to be. People realize that it's pushing us into a completely unsustainable situation. And as people realize that there are real alternatives, we could have a society now which didn't grow anymore, which satisfied human needs, and which allowed us to be ecologically sane, ecologically stable. What's not to like? We think that this is an idea whose time has very much come, and the word needs to spread on this, and it needs to spread fast.
Well, I'd like to now venture into some new territory for our listeners. You are known as a scholar of the late Ludwig Wittgenstein. And pardon my bumbling around in this. I did study it at university several decades ago, but I've forgotten almost everything about that. But I do know that in his early work in the 1920s, Wittgenstein suggested that words work by triggering pictures of facts in our minds. That was his early theory, I think. Now, there is no human memory of climate shift. Is that part of the problem? We don't have the pictures for a different climate, and so language fails.
Interesting. I think that there's something in what you've said there, definitely. I think that the way in which we have been trained to think, the scenarios that we are used to, these things are not preparing us well for the unprecedented situation of dangerous climate change. There are precedents of a sort. For example, Jared Diamond discusses them in his work, for example, his fascinating book, Collapse, How Human Societies Choose to Fail, which I think is a great title. When societies fail, it's not usually because some terrible fate simply befalls them. They do things which set themselves up for failure. And unfortunately, that's what we're doing right now. But these precedents, the kind of examples that Diamond talks about, of course, they only existed before on much smaller scales. We've never had a truly worldwide crisis before. Actually, that's not quite true. There is one hopeful precedent there, which is, of course, the ozone layer crisis, the ozone hole, which occurred in the 1980s. But that was easier to fix, and it was basically fixed, and this is why it's an encouraging precedent. That was easier to fix than the climate crisis because it didn't concern so much of what human beings do. It wasn't so integrally tied in with economic activity as a whole. So I think you're right, Alex, in saying that something which is a problem for us is that our history hasn't prepared us well for this crisis that we find ourselves in now. In terms of how Wittgenstein's thinking can contribute to this, one thing I would draw attention to is that Wittgenstein was a skeptic about the idea of human progress. Now, that might sound very unattractive to many listeners. Many listeners might think, hey, human progress, that's what it's all about. That's absolutely essential to who we are. We've got to stand behind the idea of human progress. But what Wittgenstein basically said was that he thought that the idea of progress, if that idea means something which is supposed to be continuous, and certainly if that idea is tied into material progress and material growth, is a kind of fake idea and a fake ideal, which has been actually a very recent idea. It wasn't present in most of the great societies of antiquity, for example. It simply wasn't present at all there. And Wittgenstein thinks that there are other objectives which we should place much higher than these kind of ideas of progress. He thinks that real quality of life and real quality, for example, of thought and of artistic production, that these are ideas which are better than our ideas of progress or development or growth, which have led us astray. That, I think, is an intriguing idea in Wittgenstein's philosophy, which is one that I've tried to follow up in my work in recent years.
And did he not later in his life come to the conclusion that language was not a game necessarily based on rational conclusions from the facts, but rather patterns of words with intentions to convey things like comfort or security? But then I think of Donald Trump. Maybe he's unknowingly using this failure of language to avoid the facts of climate change, but he talks about discomfort and he tries to breed insecurity in his listeners. It's very confusing to me.
That's an idea I haven't heard before, that Donald Trump might be a Wittgensteinian. I don't think so. I think, by the way, that one of the few silver linings of the current awful political situation, and it is frankly awful, we need to be quite clear about that with ourselves, it calls for a huge response in a very different direction. I think one of the few things that's good about it is that Trump and his ilk will be thrown into the dustbin of history as it becomes clearer and clearer that dangerous climate change is happening and that they have stoked it. I actually think it's entirely possible that Trump might even flip on this issue in this year or in the next few years. For example, there are so many people in the Pentagon who are quite clear about what's happening. The Pentagon understand that human-induced climate change is the greatest security threat of our time. I think that it's hard to be a president, especially a president of the kind that Trump wants to be, who wants to put America first, who doesn't even listen to his own advisors in the Pentagon. So we'll see how that develops. In terms of how Wittgenstein's later ideas might be relevant, really I think the idea which is most crucial here, it ties in with what I was saying a couple of minutes ago about how Wittgenstein was actually skeptical about the way that we are captured by this idea of progress, is that in Wittgenstein's later work, he emphasized very much the importance of human forms of life, ways of living that we are accustomed to as the basis for anything that we do. And I think that we may come to realize more as the threat from issues such as climate rises in the coming years, and it will become more and more starkly clear to us. I think that what we are about to lose will start to come home to us. And the way that our very forms of life, our very forms of existence, and indeed language itself, are under threat by all of this, will start to become clearer to us, and that perhaps when the stakes are clearer, we will move and respond and act in a different way. Now, the problem is, Alex, that if we leave it much longer, it simply will be too late. So we have to do something smart. We have to get ahead of the curve. We have to educate ourselves. We have to spread the word. We have to put our bodies on the line sometimes. We have to put our money on the line. I would say to listeners out there who might have £10,000 or $100,000 stashed away, this money is going to be no good to you. It's going to be no good to your children if the ecological crisis comes and crunches us in the way that it's looking likely to do over the next generation. Be bold. Put that money now towards some places where it can actually do good. Put it into the political process behind people like Greens or others who have their hearts and their minds in the right place on these issues. Or put it into projects which can actually help right now to conserve the world or to grow food in a better way. I think people need to think big. This is, as we've said, an unprecedented moment in human history, and we will be judged as to whether we think big enough on it.
Where can our listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, one place to start on the web is at www.rupertreed.net, where you can find a link to most of my various activities. You can follow me on Twitter at Green Rupert Reed, and that's R-E-A-D. Green Rupert Reed, and I'm not too hard to find. I'm a pretty active voice out there, and I'd love to hear from people, hear what they think of this broadcast, and I hope that we'll get more and more people joining us in what we're trying to do here. I think your radio station is very aptly named EcoShock. There is going to be a terrible EcoShock coming down the road unless we act like wise frogs and do it sooner rather than later, and I'd love to be a part of working on this with listeners.
Well, there's another part of the shock, too, intended there, and that's the sort of medical state of shock where people are in an accident and then they can't think straight for a little while. I think that's sort of where we are. We've fallen into this sort of tar pit, a trap for intelligent beings by discovering fossil fuels that stored sunlight in the earth. And I know there's quite a few YouTube videos with yourself in it, and I'm going to put links to some of your articles and YouTube videos and, of course, your site at the Greenhouse Think Tank, all that. I'll put it in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. We have been speaking with Dr. Rupert Reed. He's a reader in philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's the chair of the Greenhouse Think Tank, as I've said, and he has been trying to be a green representative and also has often been a spokesperson for the UK Green Party. Rupert, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's really been a pleasure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.